for the introduction. So my talk is closely related to Ross's talk in the sense that each of our stories is actually a chunk from a joint paper, which we sort of finished yesterday, which is long overdue. And now we're trying to get this on the archive, and we have some technical trouble there. I also want to point out something which I put a few weeks ago, I think, on the archive, which is a tutorial on monoidal categories, which is specifically written for what I would say the physicist without, which is not the mathematical physicist. It's like the physicist with not like a gigantic amount of pure maths background. So it tries to present what a monoidal category is more from physical intuition than from sort of its mathematical uses. So that's available there. It's about 104 pages. I also wrote recently a survey on all this graphical stuff which we are talking about for a journal called Contemporary Physics, which is sort of directed to last year undergrad students, so it should be easy. I'm still correcting some typos, but if you want the copy, just ask me for this. Right, so there's going to be a bit of overlap with the previous talk, but I don't think that's going to be a problem. So first, I want to make a little bit conceptual comment on this sort of approach we have in recasting quantum mechanics in terms of monoidal categories. So how do you see this in the usual way of people thinking about quantization and things like that when you go from a classical theory to a quantum theory? Well, the way in which I sort of interpret this setting is a little bit upside down. So basically, you start with your monoidal, symmetric monoidal category as some kind of quantum universe, which is below there or out there or I don't know, wherever it is, but it's somewhere. And it doesn't really matter at that stage whether we or not are part of it. So I refer to this thing as the quantum universe. I'll formally define it a bit later. So I'm saying down there in the sort of naive perspective that quantum is about the small and we are about the big, something like that. Whether this is going to be something we can retain in the future, I don't know, but anyway. Yeah. What is happening here? I don't like this new. Is anybody? Oh, okay, now it works. So we would like to probe that world, and we do this by something which I call a classical interface. Like typical example is of classical interfacing with the quantum world is like we've got our spatial-temporal frame of representation where typically most experiments take place, and we want to see some space-like manifestation of something going on in this underlying quantum world. So I call this a classical interface, or other people would call this an observable. The reason I call this like this is to emphasize the word classical. So we're probing this quantum world. So this is something you do after. So basically it's something like classicizing quantumness. You first have this quantum universe out there, then you start interfacing with it, and this sort of gives additional structure. So as a structural hierarchy, this means that classical is a bit more complex than quantum. The quantum is the primitive, and it's the moment you sort of interface it with the classical, things become a little bit more complex. There is an analogy there with something which is called linear logic, which was mentioned by Ross, where if you take classical logic, then you can sort of chunk it up in something which is called linear logic, and then adding something to it, which is some property of duplication. And it sort of gives a much better insight in logic. And what we aim to achieve here is by this factorization of first looking at a quantum universe and then adjoining classical structure to it is actually also that we hope that we will get some more insight about the quantum world by factoring it in this way. So we refer to identifiable parts of this quantum universe as systems. It doesn't really matter whether you really think that there are like things moving in there or that you're just looking at the region of space-time and you look at the manifestations. Well, then you treat this region of space-time as your system. Like it's like an identifiable part of the quantum universe. This is like the stance people take in algebraic quantum field theory. You take the region of space-time and whatever excitations you see there, you sort of treat as your system. And if there is a relation between an identifiable part and another identifiable part, then we call it a process. It's a process. It might be happening behind the scene there in the quantum universe. It doesn't really matter whether you really want to see this happening here or somewhere out there hidden behind the curtain. So it's a general notion of system and processes, which we have here. And we can, when we look at joint parts, like joint systems and processes, we refer to it by the tensor. and consecutive processes we refer to by composition. So basically, we're talking here the language of system, process, joint system, consecutive process. That's the language of our quantum universe. So formally, so the only structure we basically have are two compositions operations, like this tensor and this doing something after. So it's a very, very general concept of what you could call a compositional theory, in which you can compose things. So you've got systems, processes, composition of processes, and then compoundness. Formally, this is on the nose, what you could call a symmetric monoidal category. And then if you go want to know what the quantum theory is specifically about, then you want to add some extra structure. And this will be the extra structure of the interfaces, the classical interfaces, how you sort of probe this quantum universe. A possible model would describe your system in Hilbert spaces, your process by linear maps, and compoundness by the tensor product. But obviously, there's many other possible models. And then there is this very neat feature of graphical representation, that an equational statement is provable for symmetric monoidal categories if and only if it's provable in a corresponding graphical calculus. So you've got an algebra, which is symmetric monoidal categories, which is a symbolic representation of a piece of math. There is also a graphical representation of the same piece of math, which we saw in Rosenstock, and there is a theorem relating those two. Whatever you can prove, whatever equational statement you prove in one, you can prove in the other. So the idea is then to add more structure to this guy and try to retain this sort of graphical principle, that you've got nice graphical reasoning mechanisms which allow you to prove everything which you could prove by symbolic axioms. Reasoning is just much easier in these graphical things. Well, you could make, it doesn't mean that a graphical language could be really complicated if you want to. So you need to find nice reasoning principles. We'll see a couple of them now. So the data symbolically of a, I'm not going to go into that anymore because we saw this in Rosenstock. The data of such a category is this. Graphical formalism, we have processes, input, output. So I read my things from bottom to top like most physicists do. Identity is a wire. This is composing processes, just one box after the other. This is the tensor of processes, put them side by side. We got the notion of a state. State is a process, no input, but an output. It's like you can think of it as an operation. Think of this as a preparation procedure. You're interested in what you get. You're not really interested in where it comes from. Here is a state available. I can start operating. And the way I prepare it is not important. What is important is in what state it is after the preparation. This is an effect, which is the dual of a state. If you compose this two, you get something without an input and an output, which we could call a number, and typically will play the role of a probability or something like that. And these are obviously all well-known concepts, because here you've got the Dirac kit. You turn this a little, you close this, you turn this around, and you get this triangle. You get this one, you close this, turn this around, and you get this one. And if you start with a bracket, you close it, you turn this around, you get this one. So this is a not all too conservative extension of Dirac notation, because you really by hand put in the tensor product. To put this in an historical context, there have, like, the story of what you could call quantum logic is a very old story. There have been very different approaches. There's like people who have been working with lattices, people who have been working with things called test spaces. There is now a lot of activity in the convex formulation. But all of these approaches, the sort of Achilles heel of them, was that they failed to reproduce an abstract counterpart to the tensor product. The way you describe compound systems at a more abstract conceptual level than basically saying, oh, we describe them in a tensor product of Hilbert spaces. So all these approaches completely failed at that, to find like a canonical tensor product. So what we do here is we take some little bit of quantum reasoning, which is like the sort of Dirac bracket notation, and we add as a new primitive to it the tensor product and composition of operations. So that's sort of the logical framework. It's very different from the usual quantum logic in that they are sort of monolithically talking about one system all the time, while a priori here, we just talk about a bunch of systems, which you need to do if you want to have the tensor product as your language, because one system is different from two systems, obviously. So this is like a very convenient thing to have. I don't want to say a lot more about this. This is the dagger or the edge joint. Is you take a box, you put it upside down. If you do this twice, you get the same thing again. So in axiomatic terms, this means that you got some involution. This allows you to define things like inner product, unitarity. So it's a very convenient thing. Maybe you can build a theory without, I don't know, but it's very useful. Anyway, some examples here. So you got a category of Hilbert spaces, where your objects are Hilbert spaces, linear maps, your project, tensor product, adjoint. Ross also discussed the category of finite relations, which has sets of objects, relations, as morphism, the Cartesian product as a tensor, and the relational converse. And there is a surprising amount of similar structure between these two. If you replace Cartesian product by direct sum here, there's hardly any relation between these two anymore. If you replace relations by functions, there's hardly any relation anymore between these two. It's really, this setting is very close to this setting. Here are some other examples. So this is a category of Hilbert spaces, still, and linear maps, but I sort of factor out global phases. And something else what you could do is, instead of looking at linear maps, you look at completely positive maps. Like between Europe. So you're basically looking at mixed states and CP maps, rather than pure states and operations, and you get another category, of course. And then, again, somewhat surprisingly, there is like a big difference in structure between this one and between this one for certain things. And so what I want to do today, I want to incorporate a little bit in the spirit of what Ross said, like a lot of different like possible theories. Here are some other theories, which also Ross mentioned. This is like STAB, which is the stabilized fragment of quantum mechanics. Intuitively, this means You take the qubit, your systems will be numbers of qubits, but you're sort of only interested in six states on the Bloch sphere. The Z eigenstate, the X eigenstate, and the Y eigenstate. And you can sort of restrict your category to processes which preserve these things. And that's the stabilizer category. And this again has a very different structure than the category of Hilbert spaces. What is actually very special about, for example, this one and this one, and this one, is that the whole idea of having like bases and direct sums is gone. They don't have that anymore. And this is something which we crucially rely on when we compute in quantum mechanics, like we write down sums and vectors all the time. Now these things, everybody would agree that they're still quantum mechanics. This is actually the real quantum mechanics when you factor out these global phases, because they're all observable. And they are not vectors, but this is something which von Neumann observed very early. He said, well, we should go to projective spaces, because that's where quantum mechanics happens, not in the vector spaces. But you lose an enormous amount of structure here, which you always rely on. So if you want to have an abstract theory which includes things like this, and you're not allowed anymore to sort of start adding vectors and have bases and direct product decomposition, you need a totally new toolkit to reason about these things. So that's partly what this talk is about, to give you a toolkit of things to reason with, which apply to all of these. Now so all of these three are sort of quantum mechanics, you could say. Well, they are quantum mechanics. This is not quantum mechanics. This is like, it doesn't really matter, but we're gonna get a talk on Thursday which discusses this category, this one in great detail. Bill Edwards is gonna give a talk on Thursday saying how from the categorical structure you can see that this is a non-local theory, well, this happens to be a local theory, so that Thursday there's a talk about this. But I'm just saying that this little definition is actually a categorical formulation of Rob's toy theory. Now, if you have read Rob's paper, then you see that he talks about, well, here is a measurement and there is a measurement. So it's as if he's reasoning as if there are bases there of some way. But there are no bases. It's not a vector space he's working in. It's just sets and relations and things like that. So Can we find a common notion of basis, which also applies to this, for example? And you can come up with a whole bunch of other theories where you need something, where you want to reason about what is classical, what is an observable, and technically this means basically what is a basis, some sort of generalized notion of a basis. Because in his paper he draws Bloch spheres, but the Bloch spheres are not really the Bloch spheres which arise from the Hilbert space, it's something else. So we need to find concepts which apply to all of these settings. And so that's basically the sort of thing also Ross talked about in his talk, which I will call an observable, and we sometimes call the classical structure and things like that. And they are these things consisting of a copying operation and a deleting operation. Obviously, this is not a uniform copying operation. This is an operation which copies certain states. And these states will then be treated as the classical states of relative to that observable. So it would be the eigenstates formally. So there is a bunch of axioms. There is a bunch of axioms which Ross sort of went in detail to, and this thing is a Dagger-Frobenius structure. But the main theorem, which is the fact that in the category of Hilbert spaces, or in the category of Hilbert spaces without the phases, without the global phases, or in the category of completely positive maps, these things turn out to be exactly the orthonormal basis we usually work with. So despite the fact that in these theories, and also in the stabilizer formalism, despite the fact that these are not vector-based theories anymore, so there is no notion of starting with a vector space and then deriving your concepts of addition from that. So this structure is not visible anymore in the category. But this particular concept, allows you to recover the underlying basis which you had in your Hilbert space. And you have to look at the definition. It only involves a tensor structure. This is like a definition of a basis, an orthonormal basis, which doesn't rely on anything like a notion of sum. It only relies on the notion of tensor product. So this is sort of what this realizes. I give you the tensor product, define me what an orthonormal basis is. That's how you do it. That's how you do it. I cannot imagine that there might be a second way to do it. I'm fairly sure that this is the only one. And it has this conceptual counterpart that you think of it as like a copying operation and deleting operation. So it sort of articulates the classical abilities that if you got some data out of an experiment, then of course you can copy it, because that's what you do. You write a PRL paper and you copy it and you send it to everybody, your outcomes of your experiments. In a linear world in which you couldn't copy, every time you want to sort of communicate your result of your experiment to somebody else, you have to do it again. So if I want to tell you all my outcome of my experiment, I should do it as many times as there are people sitting in the room. So of course, this would be a bit absurd. And that's actually what this thing articulates. Right, so I'm not going to go in detail. So Ross already explained that the precise corresponding is the copying of a basis. So these gadgets here all satisfy these axioms. So what the theorem says here is that anything which satisfies those axioms is of this form for a certain basis, orthonormal basis. It's quite a strong statement. Okay, and in all these examples which I mentioned, and in particular also the toy theory, this gives you the thing you would like to see as your observable, your basis. They all arise from this definition I just gave. I'll talk a bit more about that. In FRL, something really surprising happens. Relate the category of relations, there is something like a basis there. For the simple reason that you can write down relations as matrices in zeros and ones, and they basically are the same like the matrix calculus for complex numbers. The only difference is that your arithmetic is the arithmetic of the Boolean Semmering, while when you work with matrices with complex numbers, it's like field arithmetic. So you can define a notion of basis based on this matrix representation, and then, not a surprise, each set has a unique basis, which consists of its elements. Funnily enough, with this new definition of a basis I gave, which is the same in Hilbert spaces, there's a lot more stuff going on in RHEL. And even on the two-element set, you've got two complementary bases. And Rob, without knowing it, he has been exploiting that fact to actually build a toy theory. Because that's the little bit of extra structure in RHEL which he is exploiting, that you've got more than one basis even on the two-element sets. And so he actually then takes a four-element set, and if rather than one basis, he finds like three bases there. Three sort of freaky bases. But they all satisfy these axioms I was talking about. Right, so an equivalent definition to say exactly the same thing, is the spider theorem, So Ross didn't formulate it like that. So here you got this. Here you got one definition of an orthonormal basis, which goes beyond Hilbert spaces. So this is my definition of orthonormal basis in arbitrary Dagger symmetric monoidal categories. You can prove formally that this definition is exactly the same as this definition, which looks totally different. And this definition says me that an observable is a bunch of spiders. I call these spiders. Is a bunch of morphisms with n input and m output, which have a special behavior. If you got a spider here who meets another spider there, then they become one spider. So the number of legs, so you see here is a number of legs of that spider, then there is a number of legs there. Some of the legs are sort of, they're shaking hands here. One of the necessary conditions here is that they shake at least one leg. I should say shaking hands, I should say shaking. So there should at least be one in the middle here, and then they sort of form one big spider. This definition of like the spiders who meet each other and then make big spiders is exactly the same as the definition I gave before in terms of Dagger, Frobenius, Comanoid. It's a bit weird at first, but it's a combinatorial thing, it turns out. This is a very beautiful graphical principle, because I know most people saw talks by me in the past, and by Samson, and also Ross mentioned this compact closed structure, where we say we have a little piece of wire, and by stretching that piece of wire, we can do a lot of reasoning, like about teleportation and things like that. You see, it's built in this handshaking of the spiders. I'm going back. So this is the general spider thing. I'm now going to pick a very special spider, namely a spider with two back legs, no front legs, a spider with two front legs, no back legs. I sort of specialize this picture, and then you see that it boils down to, I got a yank piece, you've got a piece of rope here, a cap, a cup, and they form straight wire. So these sort of, so you see this compact reasoning, which we use all the time, is built in this sort of shaking spiders, whatever thing. And then, I should go quick, I'm gonna go a bit quicker here, because this is sort of, this definition alone is then enough to sort of reduce the teleportation problem. I'm going to just go very quickly, because I'm going to do a new version of this at the end. Did anybody never see this? Because I've been giving this talk for 4 years. Anybody here who never saw this? Like the way that I think everybody here saw this, right? Yeah, can't imagine that anybody never saw this. I've given this talk here 3 weeks ago at FBI again. So let me go very quickly there. So I'll skip all this teleportation stuff and go to the real topic of this talk, complementary observables. Like two observables are complementary or unbiased, like people say these days, if the classical structures for one are unbiased for the other. So what is a classical structure? Well, classicality means, you know, by construction of this new definition of a basis, I call something classical if it's copied by it. So I stick it in, and I get two copies, right? And then this is sort of a normalization condition that if you stick this in the deleting operation, you get nothing. You see, this is a nice picture. You know, what is this a picture of? It's a picture of nothing. So nothing is part of your graphical calculus. It's a unit. Nothing is the thing you add to something, and you get the same thing. So this is nothing. Zero, I don't know what is a picture of zero. Zero is like a black hole, I think. So unbiasedness, unbiasedness is this picture. I take a point, you see, actually, here you see a thing pointing in one direction, there you see a thing pointing in one direction, in the other direction. I didn't really go into that, but this is an abstract way to write down the conjugates in Hilbert space. Like from this compact structure together with the Dagger structure, you actually can derive a notion of conjugate. So I'm using that. So think of this as a list of vectors from x1 to xn. So these are the conjugate vectors. This is like this uncopying operation. What does it do? It sort of multiplies them component-wise. So you get here a new vector, which is x1 composed with x1 conjugate, x2 composed with x2 conjugate. This is the adjoint to the uniform deleting operation. It's sort of like a uniformly distributed state, so just a list of ones. this means like x1 multiplied with x1 conjugate is 1. x2 multiplied with x2 conjugate is 1. And so this is literally saying that when I write this point out in this basis, all its coefficients have the same weight. It's unbiased. It's unbiased. So I'm gonna use now a slightly more sophisticated notation, because we have these two concepts. We have things which are copied by one, and I'm gonna use the color as an outside circle to say what you're copied by. And there's things which are unbiased to certain things, and I'm gonna use the inside color for unbiasedness. So outside is the thing you're copied by, you're classical for. Inside is the thing you're unbiased for. So like, for example, so if you would have a pair of complementary observables, say Z and X, then they would like this. This one is classical for which this one is unbiased. This one is classical for which this one is unbiased. So that's complementarity. This is my main theorem of this talk. Observables are complementary even only if they satisfy this picture. That's it. Even I'm not talking about Hilbert spaces here. I'm talking about any Dagger symmetric monoidal category. Whenever the classical points of one observable are unbiased for the other, you get this picture. So, right. So complementarity is supposed to be a big deal in quantum mechanics, right? So that's it. How should we interpret this? So people usually talk about commuting and non-commuting observables. I'm just taking a special case here of two commuting observables, which is two times the same observable. An observable commutes with itself. So this would be my green observable. So for commuting observables, we end up having this law. This is the law which applies to commuting observables. So if you combine them in this way, you just get a straight wire. For complementary observables, you see, if I make the same configuration, there's like a gap in the middle. There's a gap in the middle. So what is a complementarity of an observable? Complementarity of an observable is if I know something about one observable, I know nothing about the other. Right? It's sort of the naive layman's way of stating something like an uncertainty principle. And that's literally what this says. If there is some information flowing in here through that observable, there's nothing going to come out through that observable, because these wires here can just be replaced by the void. So this is just a general statement which you prove in any of these theories. So I'll prove it for you explicitly. It's very short to prove it. It requires an assumption on points. And as already Samson's made some declaration that one shouldn't talk about points. You talked about points. I'm going to talk about points too a little bit. You're very bad. I'm just going to talk about enough points. So okay. So here is the proof of one direction. I should mention some terminology. I don't know whether anybody here knows Hopf algebra, but in a way, this looks very much to the sort of Hopf law of a Hopf algebra. Well, although typically you would have something here which is called an antipode, and I get back to that point later why there is no antipode here. We'll see that at some point some antipode will appear. So that's what I'm going to just call this the Hopf law, because it's very similar to a thing you see in Hopf algebra. Right, here is the proof. I'm going to prove that from this Hopf law, it follows that classical points for one observable are unbiased for the other observable. So I take one observable and I take classical points for the other observable. You see, this one is green, that one is red. So this one is classical for the other one. What do I do? It's classical for green. So if I stick it into green, I get two copies, right? So I'm sort of applying the inverse here to the copying principle. If I stick this in, I get two copies. So I'm sort of do the inverse here and I get this picture, right? Now I use this Hopf law, which means I can scrap these two guys. You remember, this was my normalization condition, that this gave the void. And now you see, this was actually the definition which I had of unbiasedness. So from this Hopf law, it follows that this point is unbiased for the red. It's very short, very short. Maybe it's too many. So it just relies on these two definitions. Like I'm using this one to show this one. right? So that's so okay. Now we know that we can actually write this point like this because it's unbiased for red. Okay, now the other direction. So here it's here I need some reliance on a notion of point or a notion of having enough points. Basically, to prove the other direction, there should be enough classical points. Like because otherwise, like you see, this says if there are each classical point is unbiased. Obviously, if there are no classical points, there's not a lot you can derive from this implication because it would just be void information. So this sort of requires there is at least some, there are at least some classical points to be able to derive something. It's sort of obvious. So we have to assume that there are sort of enough classical points. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to prove anything, of course, because otherwise you don't even have an assumption. So now, this is the sort of thing you know, vector bases. What I call a vector base, this is sort of a slight generalization of the idea of bases, is that if you know a function on the base vectors, on all the base vectors, and they're equal on all of them, then the functions are equal, yeah? That's how you usually conceive a basis. So we're gonna need something slightly weaker. Well, actually it's a lot weaker in the sense that such a thing you have on Hilbert spaces, such a thing you have on Hilbert space, you don't have on Hilbert spaces in which you cancel out the global phases. This is gone, this property. Think about it. I think I've got a picture of it. Think about it here. So this is the Bloch sphere. The Bloch sphere is really a representation of vectors without their global phases, right? You have to cancel out the global phase to get the Bloch sphere. Suppose we know what the linear map does on the zero and on the one here. What do we know about the linear map? Well, not very much, because it could still be any rotation here, or any rotation of the things which Ross referred to as the phase group. They all preserve zero and one. So just the fact that you preserve zero and one doesn't tell you a lot. So this notion of basis really doesn't apply even to, say, projective quantum mechanics. Definitely doesn't apply to stabilizer quantum mechanics, doesn't apply to the toy theory, doesn't apply to... Well, there is. It turns out that you don't have to do that much more to get something which applies to all of them. Rather than just asking that these things agree on basis, on these basis vectors, you also have to ask that it agrees on, like, the deleting point. Here, this one. And this is what I call a state basis. I think of a state as like a vector without. And, but then you have to sort of, so you see, you have to agree on more points to be able to deduce that two things are equal. So, but and this is a valid concept of basis which works in step, spec, and all the things here. I haven't found a counterexample to something where you don't have this yet for one of these Frobenius structures. Well, the statement. So now I'm going to prove the other side of this theorem. And what you need actually to prove this complementarity theorem is that one of your two observables admits a state base. Only one, not both. And we actually have examples where there is the case that one doesn't have points, but the other one does have points of two complementary observables. And now the proof is very similar to actually the other direction. So what I'm going to do is here you got one side of this Opfler expression. And I'm going to apply it to a point of my state basis. And I'm going to show that this expression is equal to this expression on all of these points. So this is first thing. So here I've got this side. This is a classical point, so it gets copied. It gets copied. This is also unbiased for this one. So this is equal to this. And then I just introduce this from the normalization factor. I can just introduce this scalar because I know it's equal to nothing. And then you see that indeed, on the point Z, this and this agree with each other. Now I have to show the same on the deleting point. So I start with this, and now I apply to the deleting point. So this is just the cup of compact closure, right? So the spider theorem reduces this to this. So I can actually change the color here. Because it's just a cup. Spider theorem says that this thing is equal to this thing. And a circle is no inputs, no outputs, so I can replace it by this. There is some subtle reasoning with scalars, but it's correct, believe me. So you see that also this and this agrees on the degree point. So we prove the theorem. And so it's valid on a state basis, but I know some people here, it's going to come up in Bill's talk on Thursday, there are some really freaky basis structures in RHEL, and like this works all for them, this theorem works for them. Right, so what I want to do is see, so I just proved the theorem, I'm going back to my theorem, the theorem which I proved was this, that complementarity is this in a big generality of theories. So this is the picture of complementarity. Where does it come in computations? I'm just going to do some standard computations, which we do in quantum mechanics, and see where it comes in. So the typical example of a complementary pair would be, of course, the Z and the X. Like the Z copies like 0, 1 basis. The X copies the plus minus basis, right? And then, like Ross said, you got all these phases associated with them. This is not important. Okay, yeah, maybe I should mention this theorem. Because we are sort of re-axiomatizing quantum mechanics by just putting down a number of pictures. So you could ask your question, how many pictorial elements do we need more to be able to write down arbitrary linear maps in Hilbert spaces? Well, the answer is none. If you got a pair of complementary observables and you got these phase groups, which is just a general abstract concept, which Sleeping Ross talked about, then you can actually show that you can produce any arbitrary linear map in the category of Hilbert space. Actually, I'm looking at powers of qubits here. The simple reason is that when you got a pair of complementary observables, you can the X and Z ones, you can show that this combination is actually the CNOT gate. The CNOT gate, you've got these phase groups, so you can actually produce the Euler angle representation of any local unitary. Local unitaries together with CNOT gates, sort of result of quantum computing, produce arbitrary unitaries. So you can map any arbitrary state on any arbitrary other state. And then using map state duality, Choi-Jarmolkowski, you get any linear map. So this is just a statement that this is a very simple graphical language, but I can write down everything in Hilbert space with that. I don't need anything more. Right, so we've got these ones. I'm just going to skip here. I'm just going to want to go to my computations here. So I just said that this is the CNOT gate. How can we show that this is the CNOT gate? Well, we can just compute this, but we also can show this abstractly. So here I've got a classical point. I stick it in here. It gets copied, and then this, you saw this in Ross, then this gets absorbed. And this was actually the pi point. You remember in Ross's talk, he called this pi. So basically what he says is, if this Z is zero angle, then we do nothing. If this Z is the pi angle, then we do not. That's C not. So it just follows from this little copying principle here. Now something more concrete. What is the composite of two C not gates? It's this. Spider hop identity. So this explicitly, you saw this? Spider hop identity. So complementarity came in here. Spider glues these together. And here now we see this configuration gone. Identity. So this rule of complementarity makes you do this matrix computation. And now the last thing I want to show, I think, is that actually I'm gonna describe the teleportation protocol, but not just like one single wire which you stretch. I'm gonna make explicit what the projectors are. I'm gonna make explicit what the classical communication is, and then so I'm gonna do teleportation with classical communication and show that the only action you actually need to do that is complementarity. So let's do this. So you have to bear with me, because recently we put on a paper on the archive which is called Classical and Quantum Structuralism, and we sort of explain there how classical relates to quantum in graphical language. It actually relates in the following way. Something is quantum if it's represented twice by a double wire. Something is classical if it's represented by a single wire. You sort of know this, because if you represent a mixed state, then you'll write it always out. This would be a mixed state, right? So these are your classical probabilities. You see them once. These are your quantum states. You see them twice. And this basically translates to a very general abstract framework in which you can talk about classical quantum interaction, which then instantiates in the case of quantum mechanics. This is sort of somehow related to Lucian's axiom of k equals to n squared. Because you double things in this sort of reconstruction of that. It's quite related. So this would be just a pure quantum operation. I write it twice. This would be a controlled quantum operation. I have some piece of classical data, and then depending on the piece of classical data, I apply some unitary. This is something like a destructive measurement. So quantum state comes in, and I get a piece of classical data out. This is what I claim to be the teleportation protocol. It looks a bit complicated. I'll simplify it later. So you got a Bell state. I claim that this is a Bell-based measurement. I'm going to show this, of course. I claim that these are the Pauli corrections. You see, I'm not using nothing but a structure of complementarity here. These are the Pauli corrections. Now, it looks a bit complicated. The reason it looks a bit complicated, wait, let me go, is because everything is double. Hey, yeah, so everything is double. So what I'm going to do now, in this picture, you see, I'm going to sort of hide half of the picture just to give you an insight of the geometry. This is like half of the picture. You see, I don't know whether you see it on the screen. I see it on my screen. You sort of see a trace of what was there before. But I don't think it comes. So you see, here you've got a wire. I'm sort of hiding it. I'm hiding one of these just to make it easier to look at. You see what I mean? So all of this should be doubled. It's nothing but like you probe a little bit here, you probe a bit there, you send it there, and this will be, of course, the measurement, and this will be the correction. And this is the classical data, because they are different wires. These are the two qubits you send. You know, these are two communication bits. Okay. So I'm just now rewriting, just to give you insight, like this thing and this thing, you can actually rewrite like this and like this. So they now really look like this, right? They really look the same as this. And then the computation, and this is going to be the last thing in my talk. So you can show that indeed in the Hilbert space, this corresponds to a Bell-based measurement. I'm proving this here. You can find this in the paper. You can show that these are Pauli corrections. I show this in the paper. And this is the last thing I wanted to show. How do you prove that this gives you this? So I take this one, I sort of stretch this, and maybe you can't see this, but this exactly gives you this little configuration. You see, I see two connected green dots here. I use the spider theorem to rewrite them as this. And now here you see this complementarity bit appearing. That's going to vanish. That's my hope flaw. And here you can do exactly the same reasoning and you end up with this. But like the only equation I use here is complementarity. So I guess that's it. Yeah.